my name is Adrian Goldberg, and welcome to the Byline Times podcast. The Byline Times, it's what the papers don't say, what radio doesn't report, and what telly doesn't tell you. This time, how the far right exploited victims of child sexual exploitation. It is a story which reveals further exploitation of vulnerable young women by those with a political agenda, and one which challenges the Muslim grooming gang narrative of the mainstream press. It also highlights the lack of ongoing NHS mental health support for many abuse victims. You can get the full story by Andrew Kersley in the latest print edition of the Byline Times. We're going to speak to Andrew shortly, and also to the Byline Times editor, Hardeep Matharu, who commissioned it. Before we do, though, just a reminder that the Byline Times is a reader-supported publication. There are no oligarchs or billionaires pulling the strings behind the scenes. It's just us and you. So please consider taking out a subscription. Our monthly print edition combines the best of our online offerings with content that you can't read anywhere else. So do head over to bylinetimes.com if you can and take out a subscription. That is at bylinetimes.com. Welcome then, Andrew. Welcome, Hardeep. Andrew, I'll get you to unpack the story in a moment. Hardeep, though, I just want you to tell us why you commissioned this. It takes up a good chunk of the latest print edition of the Byline Times. Why did you feel it was so important?
It's such a complex story, Adrian, and I think it really merited the space and the depth we give it in the latest print edition. Andrew's been working on this for 5 months. He's been talking to some really brave survivors of child sexual exploitation and their experiences of being targeted by far-right groups to further anti-Muslim hate agendas. He's spoken to various experts in the field, and all of them describe this as a process of grooming by extremists of already vulnerable people in order to expand on divisive rhetoric. And for me, while this has been touched on by charities such as Hope Not Hate, who have done some great work on this, it's the leading charity in the field, there's a lot of newspaper coverage still around Asian grooming gangs, Muslim grooming gangs. And I don't think we're getting the full picture in terms of how a focus on that as almost the sole issue of concern when it comes to child sexual exploitation actually means that we are missing, as society, a national crisis of child sexual exploitation. This is a widespread problem, but what we're getting in the media is a regurgitation of narratives that are being used by people holding positions of high office. So one prominent example of this is the former Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, who just last year was talking about Muslim grooming gangs and British Pakistani men being the sole perpetrators of this type of offence, when the Home Office's own commissioned report into this showed that that is not the case. And so I think there's an urgency around it, given how politicians are using divisive, race-driven rhetoric, particularly in this political climate, but also because child sexual exploitation is an issue we seem to just be tolerating in society. Of course, there was massive amounts of publicity when high-profile cases like Rochdale and Rotherham and others came to be exposed. But since then, we haven't really been digging down into it. And the really courageous survivors who Andrew talked to over 5 months, they really wanted their voice to be heard on what has been happening to them after the abuse they've already endured. And other established media outlets declined to provide them a platform, which I think is a real missed opportunity and something that I hope Byline Times can rectify, because it's those survivors who are being failed. They're being put at continued risk. And it's a story that ultimately affects us all, because if we don't have a public services and politicians and a press who understand the depth and the scale of child sexual exploitation in society, then we're not going to be able to, one, protect the survivors who are now being targeted, but also generally just tackle this issue in a way that it deserves to be, considering the amount of trauma and damage it causes to individuals. And I think what I'm most proud of that Andrew has managed to do with this piece of work is not only come up with some really strong case studies of where this is happening and the implications of that for survivors of child sexual exploitation, but he's also brought to the surface why, on a philosophical level, this issue is such an important one for us to be aware of and is so often the one we want to turn away from. It's too vulnerable, it's too close, it's too horrifying for us to look at the scale of this crime that's happening. It's prevalent in society. And by turning a blind eye to it, by not wanting to get too close to the details beyond the high profile scandals, we as a society are also just tolerating a state of affairs in which this is a national crisis and we're hardly ever talking about it outside of sensationalist headlines. So I really hope that readers will take the time to read all four parts of this investigation and really just have their thoughts provoked as to how many different strands this situation is about.
And Andrew, one of those case studies was a young woman called Lara, not her real name. I just think it might be useful to talk through one individual case study. She was obviously requested her anonymity, but just so we can get a handle on how abuse victims are being exploited by the far right.
Yeah, so in Lara's case, this was the first person that I spoke to, you know, 5 months ago. Her experience was typical of a lot of those we spoke to. So as a survivor of childhood sexual exploitation in Hull, she had spent several years trying to get support, help, be it psychological, financial, whatever, just wider support to help deal with the just lifelong issues that come from this kind of abuse, to little or no avail. She was told by some other survivors in the area that there was a group that was campaigning on the issue, that was going to get survivors mental health support, access to therapy. You know, I mean, it was a godsend. The way she talked about it to me, she was praying in the taxi over to the meeting, thanking God that she might finally be getting access to some support. Obviously, when she goes to this meeting, it's very different than what you might expect. I think the perception was that it was going to be something like a charity or a support organization. Instead, you know, it's a political campaign group, a street protest group initially, from what we found out, called United Hull. They were meeting in a pub. It was all kind of older men in this room. And slowly but surely, as this evening goes on, it becomes more and more apparent. She felt it was less about survivors and more about a political agenda. People mentioned that grooming was the result of political correctness, that only certain communities do it, and some pretty graphic racial slurs were used while making that point. And even though this promise of therapy was still there, I think in her case, she felt like she couldn't continue to be associated or to go with this group. But other people she's aware of or know had connections, continued going. Some were offered therapy, others were offered financial support, food, clothing, you know, stuff to just help them make ends meet. But in exchange, there was a expectation that people ought to speak out at rallies to help them campaign. Often these rallies would end up being filled with people from the far right. And there was some real concerns about the impact that will have, right? These are victims being somewhat coerced. The description used by some of the survivors we spoke to and to academics we spoke to was that this was tantamount to a form of re-grooming and certainly was a form of re-traumatizing for these victims. And so their experience with the far right, I mean, it only worsened when they left. So this was all happening to all these survivors. And then increasingly, I think, got more and more violent. And when survivors in the area expressed concerns about this group and went to a counter-protest at one of their rallies, they were subject to violent and physical threats from leaders of United Hull.
Yeah, and this was one of the most disturbing elements of a very disturbing report overall, Andrew, which was that despite supposedly having sympathy with victims of abuse, if those victims challenged the Muslim grooming gang narrative that they wanted to promote, they were then abused by these people who had originally offered what appeared to be the hand of friendship to them.
Yeah, it seemed like there was a purity test, I think, is the sense that it gave me. And if you weren't prepared according to the, you know, multiple survivors I spoke to, if you weren't prepared to adhere to a certain narrative around your abuse, even if that narrative did not fit the reality, many of those we spoke to were not victims of any specific demographic, but actually quite diverse groups of men, that you would be immediately and violently like an opponent. One, it sticks with me that one of those we spoke to described a friend who was told by members of the far right that her and her children deserved to be drowned because they opposed the kind of narratives they were putting out. I mean, it's however violent and cruel you imagine it to be, it's always something astronomically worse in many cases.
Yeah, and another area where there was an alleged paedophile ring was Telford in West Midlands, and one survivor, there was undoubtedly abuse perpetrated. Holly Archer told you that her book about her experience was used and quotes were taken from her book and twisted, taken without her permission, twisted again to suit this particular narrative.
Yeah, and I think it's really telling where it was, because certain areas that had prominent scandals around grooming gangs and South Asian grooming gangs obviously are, you know, the prime targets for the far right. And among dozens of things we document in this article, it kind of shows how hollow the support is for these survivors if you're prepared to manipulate their experiences to the point where they feel like they're being used as a propaganda weapon. The worst part in her case was, like, what can you do about that once they've started kind of manipulating your words like that? It was really shocking and sadly emblematic of something that was happening up and down the country. The number of groups with links to the far right, both direct and indirect, that are campaigning around this, and the dodgy data put out, despite, as Hardeep highlighted, the Home Office's own research suggesting that there isn't any evidence of any particular demographic being overrepresented. I mean, you'll find a litany of terribly conducted studies, pseudo evidence to back up this assertion. And, you know, it's not just dangerous for society, but it's particularly dangerous for survivors themselves. One, having their stories twisted, but also it creates what a lot of academics I spoke to called a hierarchy of abuse, that basically certain forms of abuse were seen as valid because they fit that narrative and others did not. And once you end up in that hierarchy, well, the already dwindling support that exists is going to be even harder to access if you're at the bottom.
I think Priti Patel as well, Suella Braverman's predecessor at the Home Office, when a report was presented to her suggesting that there was no particular singular group of people responsible for child exploitation, she sent the academics off to do better research next time. Priti Patel clearly had a very formed view that wanted to find that South Asian or Muslim grooming gangs were responsible. And when the academic research didn't support it, her view was, well, go away and find the evidence. I remember that at the time. And I spoke to a researcher, Ella Cobain, about this. I found that absolutely shocking. And I know that you've spoken as well to Nazir Afzal. Nazir is a Muslim. He was the chief crown prosecutor for Greater Manchester, and he bussed the grooming gang. And there was a grooming gang in Rochdale in Lancashire. But again, that kind of confounds the idea that there are people who are willing to commit to a conspiracy of silence around this. I mean, good people everywhere want to see these kind of horrific gangs or individuals, whoever they may be, busted because they're harming young women.
Well, and this was the fascinating thing about what Nasir told me. I mean, first off, you know, he really directly pointed his finger at Suella Braverman and mainstream politicians. I mean, you mentioned Priti Patel there, but he did not mince his words when he said that, you know, this narrative has always existed, right? This idea of child sexual exploitation being something that only comes from outside, as if somehow people who are not Muslim or not South Asian or incapable of it or something. But he was, you know, very, very clear that the mainstreaming of this narrative by certain politicians has given a lot of energy and given a lot of validation to a lot of the far right who are campaigning on this. I mean, he compared being swamped by far right figures back when he was first doing those prosecutions. And he said, you know, while it existed then, it was kind of chalk and cheese compared to the size of the far right and the amount of traction the far right is getting by campaigning on this.
Hardeep, I think a disturbing feature of Andrew's report is the lack of mental health support out there generally for these victims of abuse. I mean, that creates, as it were, the vacuum into which these far-right actors can emerge. I mean, all of us should be concerned about this lack of mental health support for anybody who needs it, but particularly for these very vulnerable victims of sexual abuse.
Yes, exactly. Because as Andrew explores in his investigation, there was a reason why these survivors of child sexual exploitation decided to attend some of these meetings and were sort of vulnerable to these groups because they were at their wit's end. I mean, they needed support. And I think, again, this is how it comes back to how as a society we're prioritizing our resources and also how trauma is viewed. I think what really comes out in these articles is that it is not just something that happens to you and then you move on from. It is something that is ever present with you. And I think with that being the case, when there isn't the support there, whether it's mental health support or even if, you know, the survivors who Andrew explores the stories of, they're living in some cases sort of chaotic lives. They're not perhaps embedded in strong communities of family and friends, and therefore they need support of all kinds. And what was really poignant, I think, is one of the survivors who said, well, I'm just a working class girl. That's why I'm looked at in a certain way as a survivor, and no one really cares about what happens to us. And I think that's another aspect of it, that these people are vulnerable and really need that support. And because their lives are not completely stable, that goes against them because that creates a stereotype and a stigmatization, which I think also, to be honest, is factored into why we're not prioritizing this kind of support for the people who need it. And yeah, it's really worrying. It's very worrying because it just means that far-right groups, extremists of all kinds, can step into the vacuum, as you say, that's created and take advantage of it.
I mean, the thing that really struck me was that obviously there are these failures in the short term that have been rightly exposed and talked about at length. Police officers failing to log cases, dismissing survivors as child prostitutes rather than victims of child sexual exploitation, systemic failures by social workers to look into stuff that have enabled really, really serious cases and really, really widespread child sexual exploitation to happen. But I think what's shocking is there's been this conversation about that and potentially, hopefully, you'd see some change. But this idea of then what happens next? Well, there's just nothing for survivors there, really. I mean, the government recently announced plans to increase its support funding for survivors of CSE. But we did the maths and it would account to about £22 per new victim of child exploitation each year. I mean, it's nothing compared to the scale of this problem, which, you know, like Hardeep talked about, happens to one sixth of girls, one tenth of all children before the age of 16. I mean, it's the scale of failures to support people is, it's kind of beggars belief, really. It's one of those, it's the thing I found maybe most shocking was just this huge void that is there.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a difficult area to talk about, isn't it? But by the nature of the crime is difficult to discuss openly. It makes many people feel uncomfortable. But the Home Office's own research showed, I think, that the majority of offenders responsible for child sexual abuse are white men under the age of 30. Clearly, nobody should be demonized, no group, no individual, for a crime they didn't commit. But if we were looking to identify a group, that's where the evidence suggests the problem lies.
Yeah, I guess the only thing I'd flag is that, you know, obviously the majority in the country in terms of racial makeup is white British. So I think, I guess what the stats reflect more than anything is that this stuff is rampant in every community. And there is no evidence to suggest it skews any way, any specific community. And I think it's interesting, isn't it, that it's just so shocking and like almost virulently disgusting a crime. You can kind of understand this compulsion to compartmentalize, to other it. But the problem being that, you know, once you kind of push this as solely South Asian or solely a Muslim problem, that it's these grooming gangs committing this and little to no others, and you offshore it, right? You suggest that it's something that comes from elsewhere. Well, then all you're doing is invalidating the experiences of those who won't have gone through that.
And I think, Andrew, as well, and as Adrian, you were saying about the Home Office report that Priti Patel rejected and asked her team to look at again. Why is this othering happening? Why is this being presented as solely a Muslim issue? It can only be for political ends. You know, because the evidence doesn't point to that conclusion. And so why do we end up with politicians making announcements about Muslim grooming gangs, newspapers, including The Times, leading with these stories on their front pages? It can only be because a political calculation has been made that this is a rhetoric that should be put into the public domain. And I think that is not just deeply cynical, it is horrifying. It really is, because what you're playing with is people's lives in that. The survivors that Andrew has spoken to in this investigation are caught up in that. It is a classic example of playing politics with people's lives. And then there are all the aspersions which are cast on Muslim communities at whole. And just to be absolutely clear, as we state in the investigation, there are some Asian men who commit these crimes. That's absolutely the fact. But to see this entire issue with all of its complexity and how widespread it is as somehow just a Muslim issue is a very dangerous and cynical ploy by our politicians, by our press. And this is why we felt it was so important to expose it in all the detail it deserves.
Andrew, there are a number of right-wing organisations or organisations like the one that you mentioned who are affiliated or in some way connected to the far right. Did any of those respond to your request for a comment or come back to you in any way?
No, I mean, look, the very nature of the far right is that obviously people are not... They're not easy to contact in the way that, like, you know, the press office of a government department would be. But we reached out to leaders and groups using whatever contact methods we could and didn't get any response. As one of the people that we featured in the article put it, they're campaigning. It's not really about child sexual exploitation at its core, right? It's a political agenda. There is a belief that this is rampant and there's kind of a selection bias at play that means that they're going like, well, this issue feeds into what we've been saying in the entire time. And so that's why we're prepared to deal with it. But we're not actually going to engage substantively with conversations or engage with survivors who've given accounts of how traumatizing and threatening often the far right's behavior in this space has been. The nature of it is that, sadly, it feels like in a lot of cases, survivors are given support as long as they are politically expedient, useful, as long as they are prepared to agree with the descriptions or the narratives that the far right have around this issue.
I just hope people read it and they can buy it. So you can get it on subscription, but also Byline Times is now available in all major supermarkets selected across the country and independent news agents. So I really hope people will go and buy this. It is exclusive to the print edition. You won't be able to read it on our website. And this is an area that Byline Times will keep exploring. We think it's very, very important that we keep doing this work. So we will be doing that and we will be following up as best as we can on how survivors are being treated.
Hardeep, thank you. Hardeep Matharu the editor of the Byline Times. Thanks also to Andrew Kersley, who has written this deep dive into the links between the far right and child sexual abuse and the exploitation of victims of abuse. I do heartily recommend it. It is terrific journalism. And remember, it's funded by you, our readers and listeners. Please take out a subscription to the Byline Times to ensure that more fantastic journalism can be done and be published in the Byline Times. Head over to bylinetimes.com to take out a subscription. My name is Adrian Goldberg. This has been the Byline Times podcast made by We Bring Audio in Birmingham for the Byline Times. We'll see you again very soon. But for now, thank you. We'll see you again soon. Cheers now. Bye-bye.